Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
This was a question that Dr. Curry was hoping that we could slip in. You talked a little bit at the beginning of the program about some of your earlier thoughts and conversations that you were having with regards to intersectionality and whatever privileges black males might have on the basis of gender and then being mistreated as victims of racism. He wanted to know, can you kind of describe how maybe some of the shifts in your understanding or your thought, your view on this from where things started to where you are now?
Okay. I have two different thoughts. So, Ramon, the second thought is really about some of this later work that really talks about agency, and I want to get there. But I want to start with this notion of male privilege. I guess I would probably disagree with Dr. Curry a bit, although I couldn't give you concrete examples. I do think that black men do have access to some limited form of male privilege. That they benefit from male domination. And so male domination, the concept is, I think, very similar, that men as a group subordinate women as a group. It would be how I might start. And black men, though this is much more problematic, and there are a lot of other intersecting factors and axes of power in how they exercise that privilege or the extent to which they can use that privilege. I do think they have male privilege. So I was listening to his quote in the beginning, and I thought about him. I had this argument with Derek Bell over one of his narratives. I think it was probably the 27th year. He and I got in a really big argument about this. And yes, and Patricia Collins makes this point as well. She says a lot of times what you see in terms of employment, and I'm going to go back to the employment context, in terms of employment, that that you find a higher percentage of unemployment of among black men, because black women could always get a job as a domestic. So they, a lot of times, had jobs where a percentage of black men did not have jobs. But their jobs were kind of on a lower rung. They were had lower wages. They were often service jobs and that sort of stuff. I think we see that kind of throughout the society. So when I think about the legal profession, for the longest time, and I think that is shifting now some, a bit, not sure, but certainly at the time I was having this argument with Derek Bell, it was very clear, and I did the research and brought it to him and said, you know, so if you looked at the legal profession, look at kind of who are the stars in the academy. And go through a lot of different fields. What you will find is those stars, those people who, for whatever reason, have been kind of allowed to rise in those arenas, they have been men. They have been men. So when we look at kind of the highest echelons, if black people are present, then it's men who are black men who hold those positions, not black women. Now that may be shifting some, but that was certainly the case at the time. And so while more women, you might have actually found more women in the academy and all of those really kind of fancy spots and fancy places and mud with much higher salaries, not $3,000, but much higher salaries. What you saw were black men. So I think you do see kind of structured privilege in that that sort of way. I also think, and I talk about this a little bit in the article I did, which is now 10 years old. I think there's some newer research and some newer thinking on this. But in terms of black communities, I think that black men and black male issues are oftentimes centered to either the exclusion or at least to the kind of limitations or diminishment, that's the word I guess I was looking for, to black women's issues. That black male issues in black communities are often centered. And that's a function of male privilege. When you look at the few institutions that are in our communities, I think what you will find, and that too may be shifting some, is that you will find at the higher level, black men. Function of male privilege. So I think that is there. Now, is it as robust, if you can use that kind of positive word, as in white communities and other communities? No. And is it limited and restricted? Is this kind of access to male privilege restricted by the society for black males? Of course it is, on the one hand. On the other hand, when we talk about victimization and vulnerabilities, are black men uniquely vulnerable in some sorts of ways? Absolutely. That's absolutely true. Both of those things are true. And so when we start talking about complexity, then we have to start talking about complexity. And so when we go back to the racial profiling and stop and frisk, that's kind of dominated really by black males. So black males, for a variety of reasons, one is, you know, who do you trust, as John Calmore would say, in anonymous space, in public space. Men generally are seen as more threatening, and black men are seen as particularly threatening. Therefore, there's a lot more surveillance of black male activity. It doesn't matter what they're doing. You know, if they're, you know, singing a song or minding their business, a lot more surveillance of black men than there is of black women. I think that's absolutely true. That's what I call gender racism. But both of those things seem to be true to me.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, January 10, 2019. So I have been told. This is our 11th and final study session on Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. We are picking up the conclusion. All we have left is the conclusion and the epilogue. We only have one audio segment and we are done. The audio clip that you heard at the beginning, that was legal scholar Athena Matua. She was on the program in December of 2016. That is about the tidiest summation of what The Man Knot seeks to refute and examine. That right there, I think you heard, what a summation. You heard the biological essentialism that he mentions, meaning that just because you are a male, you are indicted as a patriarch, a sexist, a dominator, an abuser of women. Just because you are biologically identified as male. Doesn't matter if you're classified as black and there's a system of white supremacy. It doesn't matter if you are a male. Bam! You just heard it. And then you heard it. In my view, the total contradictory, asinine theory or supposition that black males, yes, they do are subject to greater police violence and terrorism, more so than black females, more so than anybody else. But if they get more attention because of this, not that this attention stops any of the police terrorism, but if these issues get covered, if they get attention, that is evidence of their black male privilege. What nonsense. I feel like even that is being too nice. It's minimizing because we're talking about lives. I will have more to say about that later, but that is Athena Matua, December 2016. She is going to be mentioned in the book, Context of White Supremacy, 10 years. Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Not, audio segment number one, The Cows. Some authors argue that intersectionality is more nuanced than this, but their defense of intersectionality's ability to analyze black males remains confined to the question of application, not anthropology. Carbato, for instance, argues that black women do not experience double jeopardy in every context, and there are contexts in which black men do. By emphasizing the applicability of intersectionality to various groups and the possibility for multiple configurations to emerge, Carbato leads the reader to believe that the method is open-ended. Through an intersectional analysis of Henry Louis Gates' arrest by James Crowley and the murder of Trayvon Martin, Carbato attempts to identify, mark away from color or gender blindness, the role that normative masculinity plays in both encounters. On the one hand, Professor Gates expected his respectable masculinity as a noted celebrity intellectual to counteract, if not negate outright, the racist stereotypes held by Officer Crowley. When Crowley engaged Gates and Gates did not back down or comply, Carbato suggests, citing Cooper's work on hegemonic manhood, Gates was drawing on his surplus masculinity. This disobedience was so great that it constituted a masculinity challenge to Crowley and led in consequence to Gates' arrest. While both Carbato and Cooper are claiming to offer an intersectional analysis of black males, it is important to realize that their work attempts to extend hegemonic masculinity theory to black men, not theorize about black men as subjugated masculinities with completely different trajectories and motivations from those of white men, as even Connell herself maintains. Similarly, but on the complete opposite end of the spectrum, Trayvon Martin was possibly killed because the black masculinity he presented, hoodied, connoted danger and violence to his killer, George Zimmerman. Carbato uses Martin's death to show how the representational currency of black men, even black boys, turns on their racial respectability and gender normativity, but ignores causes unrelated to one's perceivable identity, such as homoeroticism, psychological disorders, and homicidal rage. Under these previous accounts, identity sets the stage for all other dispositions. Even when black males occupy inferior social positions and lag behind their white and female counterparts by multiple measures of a population's health and prosperity, intersectional analyses such as Paul Butler's Black Male Exceptionalism urge us to de-emphasize their actual deprivation. This line of thinking holds that the black male must not be centered in any study or discussion as part of an effort to avoid perpetuating patriarchy. Take note of the essentialism. Black men are still men, says Butler. They don't have access to all the benefits of the patriarchy, but they have some of them. To the extent that black male exceptionalism allocates gender-based benefits, there is the danger that it reinforces gender-based hierarchy. In a patriarchal system, empowering men poses potential dangers. If we are concerned with hierarchies, then as observers, we should be able to point to specific inequities between groups that will be exacerbated by this attention. In other words, if Black men are not white men and thereby disadvantaged, are we to assume disadvantage exists only next to white men? If not, we should certainly be able to test, observe, or measure the inequities between Black men and white women, or Black men and Black women, or Black men and other ethnic women to see which inequities are exacerbated because of their maleness. Why must specific actions seeking to address Black male disadvantage be morally condemned as perpetuating patriarchy when such remedies are needed precisely because there is a very real political, economic, and structural distance between patriarchs and Black males? Surprisingly, Butler only sees Black men as worthy of this kind of analysis. We do not hear similar arguments objecting to programs for white women on the basis that their racial identity and centuries of racial gender privilege perpetuate white supremacy or the race hierarchy. Similarly, we do not hear objections to equal pay initiatives for women generally, even though Black men hold less wealth and income than white women and less education, social mobility, and income in some instances when compared with educated or employed Black women. None of these ongoing discourses or initiatives exacerbate inequalities between white or Black women and Black men, so why the dismissal when Black males are the focus? How do Black men gain power over white men and women and Black women when, as a group, Black men are struggling simply to achieve equity with them? Butler demands that scholars, theorists, and students endorse the idea that Black men, simply by being male, benefit from white patriarchy despite the sociological and historical position of Black men that makes them economically and politically vulnerable to patriarchy. Could programs that focus on young Black boys and not women and girls be based on a simple, verifiable premise holding that while issues related to both genders are important, boys and young men of color are consistently at the highest risk for the poorest life outcomes? For example, incarceration, shorter life expectancy, poverty. The resistance Butler shows toward acknowledging Black male vulnerability is permitted throughout disciplines because such condemnations toward the recognition of Black male suffering parallel the efforts of a status quo that already denies the violent conditions and death under which Black men and boys suffer more generally as males. Denying specific disadvantages of Black men and boys is proof of the position Black males occupy as already dehumanized, disposable, and allows for outrage and condemnation of the efforts to have their deaths and plights recognized publicly. No other group of people could be so easily dismissed and condemned as privileged given the horrors that confront them. Their humanity would resist it. This calculus depends on analytic assumptions about the place of Black males in relation to other racial groups that are asserted prima facie before the conditions of Black males are assessed and ascertained. This approach demands that Black men who are empirically demonstrated to be poor, uneducated, unemployed, and vulnerable to homicide at the hands of every other racial group, whites and other Black men and women, should be thought of as all-powerful and privileged over women, specifically Black women, not because they actually are, but because they are biologically male. While popular, the identity politics behind Butler's analysis, which holds that black males have some structural privilege, do little to arrest the actual deaths of black males in America, eradicate black male poverty and unemployment, or advance our understandings of the causes and underlying the murder of black males at the hands of an increasingly militarized police state. The disciplinary division asserted between black men and boys and every other raced, gendered, and classed subject, which is presumed to be more oppressed purely from an arithmetic of race, class, and gender location, prevents a serious study of the relationship between the historical and political causes of the seemingly endless violence against black men and boys. Our intersectional conceptualizations of gender progressivism are blind to the sexualized and specific dimensions of black male death, unduly emphasizing only the categories of our chosen subject rather than the dynamics responsible for the events we observe. In failing to address the deeper causes responsible for the death of so many black men, often at the hands of those seemingly charged with their protection, we fail to address America's long-standing predilection toward killing black males that is not easily reduced to the fact of racism. Intersectional essentialism. Social processes are complex and varied even within the same locales. History shows that no one category is absolutely synonymous with any dynamic of power. In some cases, it could very well be that women have been disadvantaged politically, economically, or otherwise compared with men, but in some cases, black men, for example, could suffer economic and political disadvantage compared with white or black women. These asymmetries, however, are not given the status of overarching historical dynamics or made synonymous with intersectional categories such as maleness, because maleness is synonymous with patriarchy, an overarching dynamic that is associated with and fills in the meaning of gender for the thinker. The category of maleness used by theory ultimately revolves around white maleness and patriarchy, a dynamic that most non-white men historically not only have been denied, but also have been victimized by for centuries. If the category of maleness was defined on the particular history of black men, then one might say that their rape by white men and white women, lynching at the hands of white women as a way to secure white female political freedom, and historical disadvantage compared with black women in education, employment, and incarceration would invert the idea of male superiority to the female. In this way, intersectionality depends on this sort of hierarchical imposition to legitimize the force of its categories such as race, class, and gender. To account for social groups, identity theorists must suggest that certain oppressions and hierarchies are unchanging throughout history. Individuals who identify as black are located within history as historically disadvantaged by white superiority, just as women are located by their identity as disadvantaged by their gender, by patriarchy, and the poor are thought to be inferior to the rich. What intersectionality therefore suggests is not an analytic sensibility that is capable of endless complexity and conceptual distinction, but rather the capturing of myriad historical time periods and sociological differences intuitively through the mere seeing of the body possessed by the subject, thought of as the way to place both the perceived and unperceivable phenomena operating in the social world under the hierarchical modalities of race, class, and gender. These modalities are asserted to exist and manifest themselves as obviously perceived categories rather than how complexities actually are, can and have changed, or may, in fact, be changing literally before one's very eyes throughout society. Intersectionality presumes that the thinker can intuit social dynamics and know the relative position of subjects within society simply through an account of the categories used to describe their biological bodies. In the case of sexual violence, such as domestic abuse and rape, and even the economic asymmetries between Black males and white men and women, and in many cases Black women, there is no awareness of such vulnerability within the intersectional ordering of Black maleness, since maleness is assumed to connotate a privilege built into social organizations, institutions, and individual disposition. This allows intersectionality theorists to assert that bodies outside the chosen configuration of privilege are less powerful and disadvantaged regardless of their actual position in society. In the case of Black femaleness, intersectionality affixes both knowledge and moral innocence to Black women's experience. This worry is not altogether new. Two decades ago, Peter Kwan argued, scholars who wrote about intersectionality responded to marginalization by creating new marginal categories that, by their very nature themselves, encourage the idea of categorical hegemony by focusing, for example, on the particularities of Black women's experience. Intersectionality stands in danger of pushing to its margins issues of class, religion, and able-bodiedness, as well as issues of sexual orientation. Thus, without a more developed theory of how to factor in these issues, as Crenshaw predicted, intersectionality stands in danger of perpetuating the very dangers to which it alerted with regard to male dominance in racial discourse and white supremacy in feminist discourse. Kwan understood that behind the theoretical language and attempts to attribute universality to the categorical combinations of intersectionality lurked a chosen subject, an essential, pure, and moral subject. How does intersectional analysis begin? Whose histories are used to stand in for the history of class, race, and gender used in an intersectional analysis? Who chooses these categories above all others? Which category defines or limits the others? For example, Black men have conceptually thought of work, or more accurately, the denial of work to them, as linked to their race and sex. As Black men, they were deprived of the status of the worker. Under intersectionality, such a concern would be designated under class. Without an understanding of Black male history and the specific relationship Black males have had to the idea of the worker, how does one decide which category actually refers to a specific social phenomenon? Is it intuitive? Do we pick the category we feel applies? How can these questions be answered unless there is a subject, an ideal intersection that gives coherence to the randomness of human reality? In other words, the substance and meanings of the categories deployed in an intersectional analysis will be those used to justify the particular history and marginalization of the subject chosen to represent the intersectional mode. If I choose Black males, the world would look very different from how it would look if I chose Black women or racialized migrant workers. The fundamental configuration of the category itself, based on the identity chosen, demonstrates that the results of intersectionality is not objective, able to render a repeatable analysis of social or structural organization. It is existential in that it produces possible viewpoints of social organization from the perspectives of the subject chosen. The danger of this method is that all the other histories and complexities will, at best, be de-emphasized or altogether condemned as part of the erasure of the intersectional subject centered at the intersection of the race, class, gender, and such matrices. Unlike other theories that respond to criticism in defense of the original position, Crenshaw has never responded to post-intersectionality theorists' critiques of intersectionality. Confirming Kwan's worry, championing the study of the Black woman, centering her experience in all conversations about race or gender, became a valued ideological statement where simply uttering the words race, class, and gender indicated the progressivism and rightness of the speaker and made critique impossible, since attacking intersectionality is attacking the subject placed at its center. Ignoring the external critiques leveled by post-intersectionalists allowed intersectionality theorists to co-opt the works of other scholars under their guise of internal criticism. In this way, serious methodological holes in intersectionality could be addressed by fellow intersectionalists not as refutations of intersectionality as a theory or as evidence of the efficacy of alternative systems of thought, but rather as scholarship and queries aimed at the continual development of intersectionality itself. Athena Matua characterizes this tendency among intersectional theorists by saying, through the process of a multitude of scholars explaining, interpreting, and using intersectionality, the theory was broadened, turning many of the critiques into mere expansions and elaborations of the theory, a theory that Crenshaw herself initially saw as transitional. Extending her criticism of intersectionality to the categories claimed to constitute intersectional relations, Matua insists that Darren Hutchinson's insights in Identity Crisis, Intersectionality, Multidimensionality, and the Development of an Adequate Theory of Subordination have not been fully appreciated by intersectionality theorists. Whereas intersectionality offers the Black female subject a world to herself full of her own story, her own political drives, and aspirations, her reality free from the contamination of others and the errors of her time, the heterosexual Black male is robbed of any complexity and presented as a lesser white man. He has no specific history, no specific will separate from that demonstrated by white men to which he is said to aspire. Intersectionality presents him as simply mimetic and lacking. As noted in Chapter 4, Hutchinson suggests that intersectionality assumes a far too static concept of disadvantage and privilege by its categories to offer an effective and historically accurate analysis of oppression. His theory of multidimensionality aims to complicate the very notions of privilege and subordination developed by Crenshaw's theory by focusing on the presumed advantages of heterosexuality, homosexuality, and multiple identities. Similarly, Matua has argued that the categorical assertion of Black men's advantage over Black women necessitated by Crenshaw's system is an assumption found to be inaccurate when subjected to empirical scrutiny. When intersectionality was applied to Black men, it was initially interpreted to suggest that Black men were privileged by gender and subordinated by race. That is, Black men sat at the intersection of the subordinating and oppressive system of race, Black, and the privileged system of gender, men. Intuitively, this notion seemed correct. It also seemed to support the dominant social and academic practice of examining the oppressive conditions that Black men faced from a racial perspective. Yet the interpretation of Black men as privileged by gender and oppressed by race appeared incorrect in our observations of racial profiling. While this interpretation of intersectionality seemed to capture some of the differentials between women and men in the Black community, as in wage differentials, for example, it did not capture the harsher treatment Black men seemed to face, not only in the context of anonymous public space that often characterized racial profiling, but also in terms of higher rates of hyper-incarceration, death by homicide, and certain diseases, suicide rates, and high unemployment as compared to Black women. These conditions almost seemed to negate the idea that Black men had any male privilege at all, as posited by feminist theorizing. Matua realized that intersectionality demonstrates a resistance towards seeing Black males as gendered and vulnerable, and that new terminology was needed to capture the gendered disadvantage of Black malenesses' multidimensionality. She concludes, "What Black men were experiencing was not sexism, a term that over a long history seemed to me to reference the discrimination and oppression of women, but rather was gendered racism. This term, however, presents problems for intersectionality theory because when it is applied to racialized males, it complicates privilege and disassociates it from the category of male. As Matua reports, our studies indicated that the assumed privileged gender position of men in the context of people of color was not always accurate because being gendered men could sometimes be a source of oppression. Like Jim Sidenius and other social dominance theorists, Matua realized that the distinctions between Black racialized males and white males is not merely a difference of race, but, as Hutchinson announced, a difference of a sexual masculine kind. An evaluation of the categorical assumptions behind intersectional thinking has yet to be seriously engaged in our analysis of Black males, due in no small part to the lack of scholarship specifically applying intersectionality to Black males since its inception in the late 1980s. However, as this book demonstrates, there is a certain amount of incompatibility between the evidence that serves as the basis of a theory for Black male vulnerability and intersectionality. Black men need nuanced theories and accounts of their social and existential position instead of analytic statements asserting that power, domination, and privilege are attached to their maleness. Intersectionality does not offer Black males this specificity. It reduces Black men and boys to reflections of decades-old dominance theory and conceptualizes them as unidimensional subjects who are hegemonic, mimetic, and invulnerable. There is simply no way to write about the vulnerability of the Black male under intersectionality without that act announcing his structural and corporeal disadvantage as Black and male being seen as an exercise of advantage and power over women, specifically Black women. Under such a paradigm, the Black male will always be marked by exception. That is, Black men are oppressed, but the Black male is never understood as the center of history and the conditions that uniquely affect him. His rape, his death, his poverty, his marginality, the material facts of his existence will remain negotiated and negated by the overarching ideological interests of those unwilling to accept the actual condition and disadvantage of Black men and boys. Toward a genre study that considers the Black male a complex and vulnerable human. There can never be a detente between the geographies of Western thought and those who inhabit the territories of Blackness, just as there is no thought that simply fiats the complete dismantlement of Western man. We cannot presume that the reification of categories such as gender and life on Black male bodies and their recognition will move us conceptually beyond the actual violence under which these bodies suffer. Western humanity, the humanity politically asserted on the death of Black men and boys, will always remain anti-Black by its nature. the most immediate task before the Black thinker is to construct new concepts that can support the meanings of the actualities set before him in our own realities. In those instances in which our language, the grammar of our world, cannot support the weight of the Black thinker's reality, those structures and their cultural representations must be dissolved. Black men and boys cannot continue to exist as caricatures with their humanity weighed against the mythologies holding them to be rapists, criminals, and aspiring patriarchs who aim to rule both women and society. These ideas are not paradigms of analysis. They are racist caricatures that claim theoretical relevance by the extent to which they make the sociological the ontological. These caricatures are accepted not because they express some truth about how to understand Black males, but because they express how society insists Black males already are. Ironically, the very theories that are proposed as useful analytic interventions for the analysis of Black masculinity presuppose the very stereotypes by which Black males are defined in society. The conceptualization of Black masculinity offered by such theories are so overbearing that even armed political strategies made necessary by the terrorism of the state aimed to protect Black men, Black women, and Black children against the Ku Klux Klan or tyrannical cops are posited as attempts to gain patriarchal power. The history of Black men and boys itself is revised and amended for the coherence of gender within disciplinary thought. These narratives have little to do with the actual character Black men have demonstrated throughout history or the attitudes and values of Black men and boys today. In a very real sense, the understanding one has of Black men is not drawn from a historical survey of their actions or an understanding of their positionality throughout the centuries. Instead, our understanding of the Black male is constructed on the interests of a particular class of scholars, Black and white, male and female, have in exploiting the shared fear of his existence for their own advancement within the academy. Our present academic and popular cultural considerations of Black males are not formulated on any real understanding of their plight with incarceration, poverty, or domestic and sexual abuse at the hands of male and female caregivers. Our present theory insists that the ambiguous perceptions others have of Black males in their personal lives and in society are, in fact, true and should rise to the level of theory. Conceptually, Black masculinity is personified as the aversion an individual feels toward Black men and boys. Despite mountains of historical research and sociological data attesting to the fact that the Black macho is a myth, the actual vulnerability and historical suffering of Black men and boys continue to be reduced to the impression Michelle Wallace, a 27-year-old Black feminist, had about Black Panthers she saw on television. The caricature of the Black macho is given disciplinary legitimacy under the name of theory and historical substantiation as an accurate ontology. It is a conceptualization of Black males that continues to operate within the reasoning of contemporary political movements such as Black Lives Matter, as well as the moralization of politics within the Black intelligentsia. It is in this way that such theories remain racist and misandrist, and that racial chauvinism operates unquestioned in various scholarly productions. Suspicion of Black men and boys and condemnation of their presence in the academy and theory is taken as praiseworthy. Scholars celebrate any and all commentaries that portray Black male theorists and activists as simply sexist and patriarchal, particularly supporting perspectives that hold heterosexual Black males to be dangerous to women. Instead of displacing gender essentialism, This academic milieu reifies and nurtures theories of Black masculinity that presume defects in Black males as a matter of fact. The entrance of Black males into theory, the thought of scholars, as defect is not as simple as misperception or stereotype. The distortion of the Black male and the caricatures of him that populate the pages of books and articles, lecture halls, and discourse, on the one hand, are necessitated by the peculiar fear that inspires myths shared by the university and society. On the other hand, however, the Black male's misrepresentation is produced disciplinarily and marketed intergenerationally. The expanding attention to gender has not freed Black males from history's sexual stereotypes. It has only solidified them. For many theorists, the Black man represents the untamed savagery of white masculinity. Thought is attributed to white men as a way for them to be regarded as aware of power, as able to turn their reason into a faculty of transformation despite their historical crimes against humanity. The Black male is robbed of this reflexivity regardless of his battles against white Western man. Because he is thought to be pre-rational, savage, he lacks the same features as the white male in theory. Black men are often taken to be purely sensuous creatures whose thinking about the world is thought to be little more than an extension of their corporeal selves. The Black man is thought of as the untamed violence of the white man, the depository of all negativity, evil. It is because the Black male is an affront to virtue and self-improvement that life is divorced from him. Black men and boys are theorized only as the antecedents to their own deaths. Their violence ignites the violence against them. As such, they are always imagined with a certain wrongness as Black males, an original sin of sorts that explains through a subtle circularity the reason for their failures. The Black male has been formulated by disciplines through anecdotal examples that not only represent him at his worst, but also deliberately erase him from history such that his efforts and vulnerabilities remain unknown. Unlike his white male counterpart, he is judged purely by the standard of the politics in our present moment. Whereas white men are theorists worthwhile despite their personal convictions, the Black male can never be forgiven or redeemed by his theoretical insights into a social problem. Historical Black figures are forever stained by their faults or lack of progressivism, their failure to disown themselves as male. All disagreements, political and personal, that they have had with any woman, white or Black, are proof of their sexism. Even in the case of intellectual disagreement, such as that between the providential imperialism of Anna Julia Cooper and the Pan-Africanism of W.E.B. Du Bois, the stake in the intellectual commitment is reduced to Du Bois' sexism, his failure to agree with a woman of his time, rather than his admonishment of her Christian imperialism or class politics. Black males, whether historical or contemporary figures, are judged on the basis of one standard. Do they agree with the women of their time? There is little investigation into the cause or experience that may breed intellectual and political differences between Black males and females. There is only the assertion that any disagreement with the politics of the Black female subject, even when such thinking is decadent and imperialist, is proof of the Black male's patriarchy and his inhumanity. Black male thinkers deserve closer examination. These figures deserve theories that formulate their existence as more than the negativity and fears they inspire in humanity. The Black male is neither perfect nor eternally ontologically flawed. He is a living and reflective being. He is not the discard of history or thought and thus should not be relegated to entering the perception of others solely as defect. Black males, like other reflective beings, have offered the world a specific example of corporeal existence and aspiration. While they have lacked the power to determine the abstract and categorical ideas used to capture the world, they have nonetheless expanded the realm of the living through their deaths, their murder and exclusion from the social, and their condemnation within the conceptual show to all those who are looking the unimaginable extent of oppression. It is the black male's continued will to be, despite the violence placed on him in theory and in practice, that shows us the extent to which white supremacism polices and confines black existence generally. The black male has continued to create and exhibit endless possibilities despite the genocidal logics that operate through force. And as Sylvia Winter and Huey P. Newton remind us, theory to extinguish him. Studying him, understanding the life that precedes his death, offers opportunities to learn from him. Resisting the urge to confine the black male to mimicry would allow us to see how black men and boys demonstrate unique perceptions into the undisclosed consequences of the world obscured by identity politics and academic theory. The study of his life is, in fact, a revelation of the conditions to the reality mystified by the illusions of theory. Black male studies as a liberatory knowledge schema. Black male existence and the force a black male's being has on the world around him, the imprint of his being in the world, history, art, thought, and so on, are not only the negations of the established taxonomies used by theory to describe humanity, they are also the evidence that the disciplinary theories in vogue today are simply inapplicable to black male life. As Legacy notes, liminality is the repository of the creative potential underlying human society. The black male does not simply pose a problem for the gender category, he exposes the erroneous, analogous reasoning behind the constant misapplication and misapprehension of anti-black violence and liberatory responses to it. He is the possibility of thinking beyond the arrangement of gender and power which now codify and weigh down theory. He is a bridge between the reality of the world and failure of theory, thought, reason to capture the world due to its own obsession. He is a break in the presumption of progress, whether political or philosophical. The black male, understanding his history and vulnerability, is first and foremost a problem of black study, not as a project of substitution whereby we attempt to substitute one more perfect black subject for another, but as a project of how we think about our thinking concerning black men and boys. The murders and sexual assaults perpetuated against black men are not fanciful. They are not imagined, but we have no signs that convey the veracity and force of their meaning. Creating such signs to create substance and meaning to black male life theoretically requires the uncompromising rejection of all previous paradigms. To understand black males beyond their corpses, we must reformulate the assumptions and narratives that make the current reality of gender, masculinity, and mythologies concerning black males cohere. To be seen as he truly is, the black male must be configured within a new history that tells of his complexity, his embracing of the mother right, his anti-imperialism, his anti-colonialism, his black socialism, his pan-Africanism, simply put, his struggles to realize himself within his own experiences, meanings, and formulations. He must be thought of as a traveler toward liberation, not simply as a mimetic trope. He must be thought of as reflective and deliberate but flawed, as a kind of human, not perfect, but not condemnable. He is not the perfect subject, but a worthwhile subject of study and theory. Contrary to the enthroned dogmas of disciplinarity and the stereotypes of society, black males are, in fact, the concretization of alternative forms of being. They continue to survive and invent. They embody a kind of manhood that challenges and redefines the economic and colonial schema that many forms of feminism and gender progressivism still hold dear. Their study can actually show us how to escape the perils of patriarchy as well as rid us of the desire to elevate within the higher ranks of hegemonic imperial masculinity through political ideology and capital. The black male, as a liminal being, resists simple mimicry. Structurally, he is often denied entrance into the dominant cultural generators of American society. It is this antisociality, the buried history of abuse and activity against the hegemonic foundations of society, that demonstrates a fundamentally different order of knowing, a register that presumes not somatic resonance, but phenomenological and cultural coherence. If it is to be believed, as is often asserted in the 21st century, that the location from which one theorizes is central to the insights one has of the world, then would it not hold that black males, those subjects who have been defined by societal exclusion through incarceration, poverty, unwantedness, demonization, and death, could possess different experiences that identify the border to a different register of knowledge? The black male suffers as an impossibility within the binary logics of theory. His existence to the world has been defined as the rapist, while he has been the unseen rape victim. He is both the murderer and the corpse. He lives in exile from society but manages to formulate a basis of life and creation within the betweenness of the super predator, the perpetrator of violence, and the perpetual victim of death. He is simultaneously in the minds of others but is existentially neither. He is not man, but he demonstrates himself as something more than the representations offered by the West's imagination. Because he is unacknowledged and denied, he perceives the world from an undisclosed place where thinking is needed, but that theory, thought, reason has not yet corrupted. He just has not had the opportunity to speak or describe the world in his own terms. His existence fractures gender because of its expansion of the historical scope of racism while nuancing the seemingly endless relations sexuality displays within oppression. The black male is the reminder of the limitations of the categorical frames and ontological assertions that theory has used to attempt to capture phenomena in the world. He shows that the definitions of masculinity are not only ever-changing, but also fundamentally contradictory when placed in relation to other entities. Sometimes theory forgets there is flesh in the world. For all the arguments against gender, as the colonial apparatus it is, our rejection of such an idea must be accompanied by an account of the sexed flesh that Frantz Fanon describes as a terrifying penis. To ground the study of blackness beyond the conceptual limits of gender, our thinking must have explanatory power in the world. For all of its theoretical flair, blackness is still concretized in flesh, and that flesh is differentiated by sex. The inability of the black male to impose himself on the world as he is makes him vulnerable to the imagination of others. In others' minds, his recognition creates anxiety. Fanon explains that for white men, the black man represents a raw sexual instinct, unpunished rapes, whereas for the white woman, he is the keeper of the impalable gate that opens into the realm of orgies, of bacchanals, of delirious sexual sensations. These ideas are integrally mixed with how black males are engaged in abstract processes of judgment, be they in society or in the academy, to suggest that we need not focus on the multiple dynamics of black males' sexual degradation that serve as catalysts for the fear and aversion manifested against black men and boys in society because they are an exhausting subject is an act of cowardice that elevates the theorist above the murderous conditions that take the lives of the people they claim to respect in scholarship and honor by thought. This book has sought to explore one historical process of black sexual differentiation in the zone of non-being, the difference marked by mailed black flesh and the phobias this subsequently produced. Future black manhood scholars must confront an uncomfortable truth. The black male remains unthought but overdetermined. Theory disowns his vulnerability. He is little more than the societal stereotypes and myths of malfeasance renamed for academic purposes. The world of violence the black male suffers under is unthinkable. Since the acceptance of his reality destroys ours, he is caricaturized for convenience, and it is this mockery that has been used as the basis of theory. He lacks signification in the language of gender and is erased as a subject of interest in regard to race. This ignoring, decentering, as it is called, is taught by scholars and students alike as the natural progression of compassion cultivated by the journey toward diversity of thought. We are made to believe and rewarded for believing that his erasure from thought is the moral result of reason turned to our socio-historical reality, and it is this act of erasure that is key to revealing, creating new and more complex subjects. The unthought black male being is sold to us as simply being the product of our new ethics, as ethical thought itself. His life and the complexities within must be vacated categorically so that his absence creates space for the conceptualization of other subjects. Perhaps such a world, or rather, in the configuration of this world, where ethics can be used to describe the process of thinking of the black male child as the cub of the black male beast, and where the death of black men and boys is not able to be thought of as aberrational, is not a world for black people at all. Black male studies begins with this premise. This epic, this declaring of black male life as worthy of study that arrests, suspends the caricatures of current research described under the rubric of black masculinity. Black male studies refuses the pathologization of black men and boys as theoretical advance and proposes the empirically informed accounts of black male life, its indisputable value, as the basis to condemn and object to black male death. Epilogue. Black, male, and forced to remain silent. Censorship and the subject dilemma in disciplinary conceptualizations of the black male. While black men and boys continue to be criminalized and die at the hands of the state and white vigilantes, disciplinary morality asserts that scholars should resist the urge to account for these deaths theoretically through any serious philosophical or conceptual study. Black male scholars throughout the academy have noted the resistance of journals and various disciplines to seriously consider black male vulnerability beyond black feminism or other paradigms that assume that black males are culturally maladjusted and pathologically violent. to study black men and boys outside their descriptions as problems is taken to be heresy. Any study of black male vulnerability is taken to be at odds with and thereby an erasure of black female suffering and, more generally, theoretically irrelevant despite black males' actual social condition. Conferences are reluctant to accept papers, editors discourage submitting such work for review, and there is vitriol toward the authors of such works that allows booing, ridicule, and intimidation throughout the academy. In my discipline of philosophy, one text has yet to be written that specifically analyzes the life and experience of black men and boys in America. The at-large morality, in fact, demands that one never be written because black males are not thought to be the right subject of study. For example, when the editors of an anthology analyzing anti-blackness solicited Eschatological Dilemmas, Chapter 4, as a contribution, they condemned and then dismissed my focus on black male death and rape. They suggested that my work would have been easily publishable had it been submitted as an article to a journal. But for the anthology, it was said that analyzing the historical and sociological realities of black males would have unjustifiably privileged them as subjects of study and disrupted the overall tone of the volume. One email stated, "The other editor believes the essay comes across as preferring black men. I think it is a bit fuzzy. It could be stated more clearly, particularly because I think some readers would find an essay on black men suspect from the start. The, oh, here we go, syndrome." Obviously, this would be something we would want to stay clear of, that is, privileging black men. Notice the conflation. Arguing for the study of the black male, or in this case, the black male corpse, is taken to mean privileging black males. Contending that black men and boys are subjects worthy of study is such an affront under the gender morality of our day that such works demand the activism of scholars to prevent such writing from seeing the light of day. This censorship of scholarship dealing with black men and boys both demonstrates and reinforces the unquestioned racist misandry at work within disciplines. While white, male, and female authors are thought to serve as theoretical guides for various racial projects regardless of their personal and historical racism, and they can even become sociologically interesting when they realize and own their white privilege, black males who remain oppressed and largely absent from the academy as students and professors are considered pariahs when they are centered as victims. While journals, college lectures, and books remain dedicated to and composed of endless engagements with white men who supported slavery and believed in black inferiority, as well as white women who conspired alongside the mythology of the black rapist and held black people to be of a savage kind, it is only the writing about black men and boys that is censored and deliberately prevented from being conceptually engaged. Denying black men and other scholars who interpret black masculinity outside feminist paradigms access to journals, book contracts, and specializations or employment dedicated to theorizing about black manhood originates in a dangerous chauvinism that is used to rationalize pathologized accounts of the black male as undoubtedly true and beyond contestation. The black male shall not speak. He is silenced, not simply by disciplines, but also by the at-large morality of the scholars who constitute them. it is not that black men and boys do not actually and in reality suffer the greatest societal disadvantage for being black and male. It is that the intersectional calculus that dominates the interpretation of black masculinity denies black male disadvantage even when it is empirically demonstrated. In short, under our current disciplinary regime, black men cannot be recognized as the most disadvantaged, not because facts demonstrate otherwise, but because theory denies that such recognition is possible because their sex is male. They are simply the wrong subjects to center as the origin of theory. Since no counter evidence or explorations are allowed to challenge the rampant dogmas about black masculinity, disciplines from philosophy to gender studies are allowed to maintain ahistorical mythologies and self-referential theories about black males without accounting for the disadvantage black male existence has in the world materially or verifying the alleged privilege black males enjoy within America's social organizations, its economy, prison industry, institutions of higher education, and so forth. While these inaccuracies themselves should give any serious thinker pause, the most dehumanizing aspect of this paradigm is the assumption that the reporting of black male death is no different from writing about black male life. Saying that black men and boys die does little to capture the causes that extinguish their lives. This reporting requires no academic engagement. It simply requires the interpretation of the black male lives lost. Often, these deaths are not thought to be of the kinds important enough to learn more about. Black male deaths are normalized. We already know they happen constantly in our society, so they need not be analyzed. Because black males are known to die, we need not make them a subject of study. There is no need to divert theoretical resources to the facticity of their demise. Attempting to do so, to study black males as affected by particular ecological or ideological forces, is reduced to the, oh, here we go again, syndrome. This is the pathological power of the corpse maintained by black and white scholars alike, where the overrepresentation of everything black and male in the dead body is presented as evidence of the black male's social savagery and disciplinary irrelevance. Since 2002, homicide has been the leading cause of death of black males age 15 to 34. Those black males who seemingly escape the finality of death live to suffer from mass incarceration, poverty, and unemployment, and often seek escape through suicide. Although these realities have endured for several decades, many gender theorists insist that the deaths of black men need not be accounted for beyond the phenomenon of racism that affects all black people equally. In our current political disciplinary milieu, patriarchy is thought to direct its violence primarily toward women through misogyny, despite the historical and sociological findings that show Western patriarchy to be a structural system that directs its most lethal violence against racialized outgroup males while preserving the lives of females through paternalism. As a subject of study, the black male is a persona non grata. Young racialized males repeatedly have been shown to be at the greatest risk for witnessing and becoming victim to violence, factors that make them more likely than other groups in similar environments to suffer anxiety, depression, or aggression as a response. The vulnerability of this group is often ignored by race scholars and gender theorists because of the overwhelming societal stigmas attached to black males. as the Social Policy Report, The Development of Boys and Young Men of Color, recently explained, the vulnerability of young men of color to death and violence often goes unnoticed or is dismissed because their victimization is seen as caused by their own criminal behavior and violence. Because black men and boys are often represented as dangerous and violent in society, they are brought into theory similarly. Said differently, black males are dismissed as victims of violence because they are conceptualized tautologically as the cause of the violence and death in the communities that have the effect of causing their violent deaths in these communities. Discouraging theoretical works written solely for the study of black males allows for an implicit but permissible censorship of discussions and writings that direct attention toward black male vulnerability, be it political, sexual, or economic. This censorship not only discourages new thinking about black males, but also denies that there is a need for new theories beyond the generic language of intersectionality to speak to the death, poverty, and societal dislocation that disproportionately affects black males. In short, black men are the only group in academia that is morally condemned and institutionally excised for attempting to build theories on the experiences and oppression of their own group. Black men are demanded to interpret themselves through the lens of others, coerced into explaining their existence through the theories and biases of white, bourgeois, and various feminist lenses. This inability to theorize racialized male experience freely discourages research into dilemmas peculiar to black males and ultimately coerces black men into accepting their erasure as a matter of theoretical advancement. This silence takes advantage of the deaths that cause black men to be underrepresented throughout society and the racism that makes it unlikely that they will graduate from high school or college and ultimately be present and considered in the academy. In other words, the deaths and incarceration of black males in society create the shortage of the actual bodies needed to constitute a demographic as students or professors capable of being represented or recognized as needing to be theoretically accounted for within disciplines. This book represents an analysis of racism and patriarchy as it has historically affected black males. It endeavors to show how black males, as subordinate racialized males, are victimized by sexual impositions of this white supremacist society. Insofar as the categorizations of black males are ideological, as in the mythologies of the black rapist and the black criminal, and structurally enforced, as in mass incarceration and policing, various groups and individuals who are not black and male can perpetuate and structurally benefit from what I have termed racist misandry, that is, the peculiar brand of sexual racism against black men and boys. This book dares to theorize black males as victims and, in some cases, as more disadvantaged than their female counterparts. The evidence showing the black male's victimization through rape and other sexual violence, as well as homoeroticism, will be regarded with suspicion, not because such claims are not true, but because such contentions deeply challenge what many students, scholars, and theorists intuitively take to be true about how maleness is situated within the gender concept itself. I can only hope that careful readers will be prompted to place their beliefs in proximity to the evidence presented. No matter the evidence, some will condemn this book because it cares for and centers black men and boys. Theory insists that they are not the right bodies, not the right story. I deliberately defy this always present but often unannounced norm. This book argues that it is racial chauvinism that tells scholars, students, and the public that black men and boys are not worthy of study, that they have no perspective worth considering as intrinsically valid and true about the world, but it is racist misandry, the visceral hatred this society has for the black male that celebrates his death, finds humor in his rape, and exhibits indifference to his suffering. It is this same hatred of black men and boys that allows scholars to deny the suffering of the black male because they prefer other lives to his. In this regard, I understand that this book may not be written for this time, for those politics, or for those scholars, because this book is written to serve as a basis for a new kind of study that engages black males beyond the threats they are assumed to be and the phobias imposed on them. This book not only endeavors to think differently about black men and boys, it endeavors to establish a genuine theoretical orientation to their study and thus to escape, to reach beyond the thinking and thinkers of this time. Context of white supremacy. That is it. As I said at the beginning, we will not have a second audio segment. We are all done. The cows. Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Not, Race, Class, Genre, and the Dilemmas of Black Manhood. Woohoo! Moving on to a new book. Listeners can help decide. Should only be folks who listen to the book club. That is one thing sticks in my craw when people vote for the book club and then do not participate. But I was thinking we should read Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl. That was mentioned in Pamela Evans Harris in her book, Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. And then it was also referenced in The Man Not. I think Mr. Demery Ford was the only reader, unless my memory is really bad, only listener who had read Harriet Jacobs' work. So I was thinking that would be a pretty solid follow-up. I think that got votes before. That was one that I thought we should read like years ago, and we didn't get to it, so I was strongly thinking that would be a good one to read, and means we would be reading that book for Black History Month as well. So, but if people had another idea, I also thought Mumia Abu-Jamal, since it looks like, you know, a lot of attention might be focused on his trial for this year, that might be a good choice. Live from Death Row in particular, I've already read that. I do not think there's an audiobook, and I absolutely am not narrating a second book in a row. So a listener or someone would have to be willing to narrate Live from Death Row. I also thought Sundown Towns. I think there is an audiobook for that, and I think I might actually already have it. But Jim Lowen, I think Sundown Towns, very important text, has been referenced a lot. Those are three that I was thinking. I even thought Michelle Obama's book, but I'm a little leery. I'm not sure if it would be constructive investment of time and energy. I'd have to double check, but perhaps. If listeners have a thought, feel free. Those were four that I was thinking of. But before we move on from that, we will conclude Dr. Curry's The Man Not, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you have concluding thoughts, if you read the text, I'd be especially interested if we have any listeners, if you had already read Dr. Curry's book. This is not like brand new. It was published a year ago. He'd already been on the program to discuss the book with us last summer. And again, we even addressed it in September of this year. So I am sure there are listeners who had already read this book, or I hope there were. If you already read it, did anything stand out the second time around, something that maybe you didn't understand or something you hadn't thought about reading it the second time around? I'm especially interested, any of the folks that were with us when we read Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, worst book I've ever read. People that were with us for that text, that is the reason why we read this book, The Man Knot, Dr. Curry's work, because of what we read in Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. Do any of the folks that were with us for that text have a better understanding of the problems that I pointed out with that text and why I said that text is a great, if you want to use that term, put that in quotes, illustration of what Dr. Curry is talking about with regards to Black misandry and these representations of Black males as being, and even the word feverish, right out of Michelle Wallace's Black Macho and the Myth of the Superwoman, right out of, she uses the exact same word to describe Black males in the 60s. Do folks have a different view or different thinking having read this book after we read Black Love is a Revolutionary Act? As well, certainly, any concluding thoughts? Again, we don't have a second audio segment. This is it. We are all done. I did not read the acknowledgments. The cows is referenced there. You can, you know, flip through to read that for yourself if you so desire. But we went beginning to conclusion. So final thoughts, overall impressions that you will take away from the text. If you dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. If we have any folks who contacted Dr. Curry as we were reading, that would be grand as well. If you took advantage, as I said, if you read the book, you should take advantage. I am certain, I know there were listeners who did email Dr. Curry. They did have questions and they said he responded as I thought he would. So if you were with us, if you didn't understand something, you have a question about something, you think something is inaccurate, drop him an email, drop him a tweet. I know he responds. I am sure he will reply. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, proceed. The lollygagging, there are multiple folks who have hands up, should be moving along if you have questions, thoughts.
Hey, how you doing, Gus? This is Carl out of New Jersey.
Right, poorly.
Now that I've listened to the audio and also listened to Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, I do see the Black misandry that was through Pam's text. I thought this was a profound statement when he says he is both the murderer and the corpse. I think that just speaks to just the whole contradiction. This text also gave me the ability to navigate through the rampant Me Too allegations throughout the media, and this latest R. Kelly spectacle. So this was definitely an educational text for me. Dr. Curry has given me basically gave me a better way to articulate what it means to be a black male in these here United States. Often it's very difficult to express what it's like, being a black male to my female counterparts. Very dismissive of our experience. It's more of just as we in closing when it's like, oh, you know, here we go again. When we talk about the plight of black men, even when speaking about the sexual assaults or that we encountered as children, as growing up, it's always I agree with Dr. Kelly, from my experience, very dismissive. So this is definitely an audio read that I will go back and listen to more than twice. I might listen to this about three times over to get a better understanding. But great work from Dr. Kelly.
Much obliged. Appreciate that caller in New Jersey. Other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary or if you have a hand up, line should be open. Greetings, Thomas in New York.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to all the callers. Excellent work from Dr. Kerry explaining what it is to be a black male in America, not allowed to be a black man in America. Excellent work. Man, it's not a lot of work that I've ever heard that didn't focus on the women as well. So I think he did a great job of pretty much sticking to the point of, black males' treatment here is pretty tacky, terrible. We're terroristic, you know. The list of the new books, Gus, I'm with whichever one you choose. I was just going to say that. Do you think, Gus, that it is, and I hate to put this in, I know this will be a hard question to ask, so answer. Do you think that it's harder to be a black male in America or a black female in America? What was your answer to that? Or equal?
It's difficult to answer. And I guess I'll give two illustrations, and I can loop back to Dr. Curry's work. Maybe I'll get an extra piece of cornbread for being able to connect what we're doing here. So you can go back to 2014. Dr. Curry was on the program, and I'm trying to think of the exact case. So I don't remember the exact case, but it was a lot of them. This was like Eric Garner, Michael Brown Jr. I mean, you can pick the case. Black, here we go again. Tons of black males were being shot and killed that summer by a variety of whites. Now, he came on the program, and he was saying that Ayanna Stanley Jones, who was shot and killed by police in 2010, black female, she was, I think, 6 or 7. He said that the police came in, they raided the house. They didn't come in to kill Ayanna Stanley Jones. They came in for a black male. And he was saying that a lot of the terrorism and violence in areas where black people reside is directed at black males, and black females and children, everybody else, they end up being collateral victims as well. But a lot of this violence is specifically targeting black males. That was what he said. And he used Ayanna Stanley Jones' case as an example. It may have been. I'm not sure. I'm still, you know, reporting. It's being updated as we go with the Jasmine Barnes situation, the 7-year-old down in Texas who was shot and killed. And they have arrested now 2 black males in the shooting. And they say that one of the black males confessed to doing the shooting. And they're saying that there was a mistaken identity. He thought that this was a different vehicle. And at first they said that it was a white guy who did the shooting. And now you got this black person and all this other controversy. But if what they're saying is accurate, these black males did the shooting and they were looking for somebody else, could have been a black person, could be another illustration. Now, it's a whole lot more to research. That might not be. We'll have to wait and see it out. But if what they are reporting now is accurate, that could be another illustration. So I use those 2 illustrations. It's difficult to say. If you are a black female, you're going to be around a lot of black males. So, you know, it's not like you're in a safer position per se, even though a lot of that terrorism and violence is not focused on you specifically. Black males have a lower life expectancy, more difficulty getting employment. You know, it's difficult to say. It's one of those where I mean, it's all of us are in such a bad position on the boat. You know, I definitely think in the system of racism, white supremacy, the violence, the person who is going to be most directly impacted and most targeted by violence, I think unquestionably, is black males. Athena Matua said that. Dr. Curry said that. Lowest life expectancy, most likely to be homeless, most likely to be a victim of violence, most likely to witness violence, all black males. I mean, it's horrendous, but, you know, it's terrible for everybody. That might not even, and as you said, it's difficult, you know, to even answer such a question. It's terrible for everybody. We should solve the problem.
I agree. And I think that answer was very, very good. You showed a great example with the little girl who was shot in Detroit, I believe, and they did come in looking for a black male. They wasn't going there to shoot her. Great example. I think before this book, if I was asked that question, I would have definitely said black women. You know, but this book did put that in a whole different perspective. That's why I asked the question. You know, I think that I would have had so many examples to give of things that have happened to black women and not even thought of some of these things that Dr. Curry pointed out, some of the, you know, theories, which I think are all true that he used. So I thought it was a really good book. I do critique the way that it was written. I wish that it was written for everyone to, I could give it to someone who has a, you know, second grade level understanding of the system, you know, I can give it to them. But very well done. And I'm Mom, thank you, Gus.
Yes, sir. Thomas in New York. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary to share, should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Greetings, retired firefighter.
Greetings, everyone. My thoughts are, and I'm thinking from more or less a warfare and or military perspective, that the out of the two, black male, black female, that the black male would be the major threat to overcoming the global system of racist white supremacy, primarily only because of the physicality potential. And therefore the white supremacists have to suppress that. The only time it's allowable is, I say, primarily with sports and or some other form of entertainment. Even something like dancing, you know, as far as the physicality part is concerned. There's a lot of equality between black males and black females just by the nature of things with people. And I also don't think it's a big difference from a mental standpoint, as some people pretend to that it to be. I don't think it's that far away, but for the most part, I would say it's something that the white supremacist has to monitor constantly and strike down or discourage. And I would say that's probably the main difference between the two. And not only in this part of the world, but on a global standpoint. Those are my thoughts.
Much obliged.
You did mention about. Excuse me. I'm sorry. You did mention about the book, the two books. And can I go on to give a brief answer to that?
Let's hear it.
Okay. Sorry about that. With his book, of course, he basically was a quite difference of thought on the subject of black males, of course, and not so much from a standpoint of just being disagreeable with Pam's book, but from a logical and scientific standpoint. It presents itself with a lot more of research and analysis as opposed to the other book, primarily, I think, was emotions and personal experiences probably entered in much more than almost anything else with that particular book, as opposed to Dr. Curry's book was more or less from a scientific and a historical perspective to be able to educate the reader, no matter if it was male or female, as far as the reader is concerned. And I would say it's like far away from Ms. Pam's book in terms of that comparison. And that's it. Thank you.
Much obliged. Let's see. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed you totally, if you have commentary, proceed.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Demi-Four?
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Is there an echo?
There was, but it seems to have vanished.
Okay.
Now you have vanished, Mr. Demi-Four. We could hear you, and there was no more echo, but now we don't hear you or the echo. Mr. Demi-Four? Uh-oh. Technology issues. Very familiar with those, unfortunately. Get the best of us. We're not hearing you at all, Mr. Demi-Four. So if you can hear us, we can't hear you at all. If you want to hang up and dial back in, we'll just nab you on the switchboard. Let's see. We'll try again. Let's see.
Okay. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Sorry about the problems. I can attest to what you were saying about the other book being one of the worst books we ever read. And also pointing out the racist Miss Andrew or the black Miss Andrew, because that's something that I know I hadn't thought about before, but the points that you brought up and then the eloquent way that Dr. Curry has laid it out for us, there's no mistaking. You know, before I forget, I was wondering if the lady that we heard speak at the beginning of the show, I thought that, yes, you know, she's, when you asked her question, it seems she disagreed, Miss Matui, Althea Matui.
Athena Matui?
She seemed to, Athena Matui. She seemed to disagree with Dr. Curry's theories, you know, from the question you asked. I may be mistaken. But in the book, where it says that she reports, our studies indicates that the assumed privileged gender position of men in the context of people of color was not always accurate, because being gendered men could sometimes be a source of oppression. So it seems she agrees with him there. So unless I'm mistaken, that seems to be a contradiction of what she laid out in your interview. But I'll go on. In the category of maleness, talking about the history of black men being raped by white men, white women, lynched at the hands of white women as a way of securing white female political freedom. You know, I thought that's very deep there. And historical disadvantage compared with black women in education, employment, incarceration would invert the idea of male superiority to the female. You know, it doesn't surprise me, but anything that seems to be positive in the way of bringing about some progression or positive change, and for his theory and then the actual application to help black males, it seems to be an absence of that. And then every attempt seems to be, you know, countered. So it seems to me that it's obvious from academia and also in the literary field, as well as even African-American history, that there has been inaccurate information, you know, disseminated. And it's very important, because how can you bring about change if you can't even get recognized as, you know, there being a problem? And then every time you speak of a problem concerning intersectionality, then the feminists bring up the erasure theory. I mean, just because we bring up our positions does not erase the position of the black female. And also, you know what? What really gets me is the fact that he feels that the black males have accepted these caricatures and these images of ourselves in a negative way. And so I think it's important that we bring up to the young black males in the society exactly what's happening here and what's going on, that they are going to be forced with consistently at a high risk for poor life outcomes, incarceration, shorter life expectancies, poverty. I mean, you growing up as a young man, I kind of had an idea that I was up against pretty great odds, but I grew up in the rural South, and I had no idea that the deck, that all this was stacked up against me to start with. To bring something up to date, there was a young man recently with his cell phone broadcasting live on Facebook, said he was walking into a police station, and he said he was going in there and the police was going to kill him. And he went into the police station actually filming live, and right now his death is being investigated. I mean, I think that if that particular person had this kind of information, or if he had had the knowledge that we occupy this position in society, I think he probably would have chosen another project than that particular project. It was also interesting that the book says on 223, the conceptualization of black masculinity offered by such theories are so overbearing that even armed political strategies made necessary by the terrorism of the state aimed to protect black men, black women, and black children against the Ku Klux Klan or tyrannical cops are posted as attempts to gain patriotic power. You know, it's a constant minimizing of the efforts to be able to live your life as a black male as you actually are and not as the way society views you. And I wanted to mention briefly about Henry Louis Gates. I don't know if I agree with what they were saying about Trayvon Martin's masculinity being in the hood. I think that a better illustration of his masculinity would have been trying to protect himself physically, being a student of MMA. But Henry Louis Gates, Cowbell, he underestimated his so-called, I don't see the word that they use, his masculinity. And he was quickly shown that regardless of your financial status or celebrity status in America, you can be humiliated even further. And I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Absolutely. I think many of us have been unfortunately reminded. Other folks that dialed in with a hand up have commentary. You miss anybody? I'll share a thought or two. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I'll get to some of the notes. And even before I get to some of my notes, legal scholar Athena Matua, again, she was on the Cows the end of 2016. Mr. Demery Four pointed out that in the text, Dr. Curry quotes a passage from her where she says that, you know, if you look at the evidence, you know, it would seem to refute the very notion of black male privilege completely. Now, this was published before she came on our program in 2016. The audio clip that I heard, it did not sound like she was refuting the idea of black male privilege. In fact, it sounded like, or it's not sounded, she was emphatically asserting that, oh yeah, black males, they might be subject to gendered racism. They might be vulnerable in certain circumstances. They definitely are subjected to more violence. She agreed wholeheartedly there. More violence, police terrorism, all of that, absolutely. But in certain instances, they have black male privilege. And what I thought was extraordinary, and I don't even think that's the most accurate word to capture the absurdity. She said, I can't think of any concrete examples but I believe that black male privilege exists. That is absolutely absurd, and I don't even think that's the correct term. Like, I feel like it would be totally valid if I wanted to insert a profanity right there in terms of to be in a system of white supremacy. Black males, most likely to be incarcerated, most likely to be homeless, lowest life expectancy, most likely to be a victim of violence in that environment, to assert, and not just someone off, you just go grab a vagrant and ask them, you know, what's their opinion. And I mean, even with them, Victims Guarantee Qualified, VGQ, but a legal scholar, like, you have degrees and you've done research, and to say, I don't have concrete examples, but I believe that black male privilege exists. That's in the archive. And then, and in fact, I'll even stop right there. And I'm giving a metaphor, so, you know, be alert. Dr. Kenneth O'Reilly, white man, suspected racist. He wrote the book Racial Matters, the U.S. Secret, the FBI secret file on black Americans from 1960 to 1972. He was on the program, 10 years of the cows. He was on the program in 2009. He said, J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI, they went after Marcus Garvey, black male. They went after him. They didn't have any evidence that he had done anything wrong. They just went after him. Nigger is guilty. We know it. We don't know what he's done. We don't even have any evidence that he's done anything wrong. But we know the nigger is guilty, and we're going to get him. That is the thinking that is applied with black males. Don't need any evidence. Already know. Nigger's guilty. Get him. Ah, lynch him. Cut off his penis. That's the black male. That's just the way that we... That's why I said that statement before when Dr. Curry said black males, we already think of them as racist. We already think of them as sin. We already think of them as evil. Anything that is vile that can be projected, we don't need any proof or evidence. They're guilty. Continuing with Athena Matua, she was grasping for evidence as we went on of black male privilege. So she pointed out, incorrectly it turned out, that black males, their income was somehow comparable to white women. It is not. White women make more than black males. She pointed out, and she conceded in the interview that she did not have statistics to verify this at the time, and it turns out these statistics evidence that she was incorrect. She continued, and she said, in fact, I don't even have to talk. I can read. We talked about this, and I said on the program, it is absurd to have someone in a system of white supremacy talking about the notion of black male privilege, and that's not even the most accurate term. She wrote, Dear God, and this, let me give you the date on this here. Let's see. Boop, boop, boop. So this is after she was on the broadcast. So she was on November, not December. November of 2016, she was on the program. So she emailed me on November 23rd, 2016. Dear Gus, I hope this note finds you well. Thank you for both inviting and allowing me to participate on your radio broadcast. I enjoyed the conversation and the bit of debate that we had. I also enjoyed your listeners' questions. Thank you for the opportunity. After our conversation, I continued to listen to your broadcast, but I found it also a bit interesting. Wait a minute. I found it interesting, but also a bit disturbing. I was disturbed by some of your characterizations of my comments, but it reminded me that it's important to know your audience and the views of your interviewer before embarking on what you might assume is a friendly or like-minded dialogue. Thank you for the reminder. Here are a couple of things I found interesting or disturbing. That word again. Number one, you asked me for a definition of privilege. I gave you an example of it in operation. You appeared dissatisfied with an example, so I gave you a working definition. It was privilege is access to the benefits of domination. While I conceded that the word privilege was not perfect and that it may well obscure relations of power and domination, it may also add something to the debate. What is that something, and is it constructive? That is a question. Continuing, she says, that something is the idea. Just because an individual who belongs to a dominant group, white or male, does not believe in white or male supremacy, this does not mean they do not benefit from it. I will stop right there. This is what I mean. This is nonsense. We don't have time to waste. You're not talking about the system of racism, white supremacy. This right here, you're making space for white people who do not believe in racism, white supremacy, do not practice racism, white supremacy. That's nonsense. We don't have time for that. That's nonsense. And not only that, it's tying it back to male supremacy. And it's not just male supremacy. It's these black males and their black male privilege. Continuing, she says, number two, despite your concern about the word privilege, you asked me about black male privilege. I explained that black men had some privilege by virtue of being men. That's what I mean, Mr. Demery, for she is not. She is totally contradicting what Dr. Curry quoted in the book. It was to the point where I felt like Dr. Curry should have quoted this, what she said on the Cowles interview, because this is more recent. If you're going to refute this, if you're willing to come out in public and refute totally what you said and talk as though, oh, yeah, black male privilege exists, and I'm going to point out some reasons how it exists, hey, let's direct that, because this is another illustration of exactly what he's talking about in the text. Continuing, she says, number two. I explained that black men had some privilege by virtue of being men, biological essentialism, exactly what he talked about. But I noted that this was complicated by race, which meant that in some circumstances, black men were made both more vulnerable by being black and male. That is, they suffered from gendered racism, as in racial profiling, the subject of my work some time ago. In other words, the reality of black male lives is complicated. Now, see, she still didn't give examples of, well, where are the times where they are enjoying the black male privilege? She just hops immediately to, well, yeah, sometimes they're vulnerable, but they got black male privilege too. Continuing. It's not either they are privileged or they are victimized by gendered racism, but both instead. From my perspective, black men benefit from being men in a male-dominated, male supremacist society. Here you wanted examples. I gave you examples of wage differentials and community-focused leadership. Though I could not remember the details of the wage differential, these differentials are persistent facts that even your Dr. Curry has had to deal with in arguing that black men have no privilege, even if they are not sexist, doubtful, or do not believe in male supremacy. Pause. That is just categorically false. I sent this email to Dr. Curry, and he came out and immediately said, I can read exactly what he said too, but for brevity. And he said, number one, she is a legal scholar. You should have the data. Two, you're wrong. Black males do not make more than white women, and the differential between black males and black females is very low. And he immediately pulled the statistics from the U.S. Department of Labor. He addressed, he didn't have to fudge or make up anything. He went directly to the statistics, which further corroborated his point about the fallacy, the folly, the nonsense of black male privilege. What are you even talking about? Continuing, and she also within this, before I continue even reading, she said this idea about black males in the quote unquote community. Again, there is no such thing. Black males are not in charge of any black community. If there was, we wouldn't even be having this conversation, because that would mean there is no white supremacy. So, I mean, we're not even talking logically. All of the leaders of black people are white. I don't even know who you would be. Who are you talking about in terms of black male leaders? Al Sharpton? Kanye West? Bill Cosby? Who are you even talking about that is in charge? If anybody here has a name of a black male, let me know. President Obama? Who are you talking about? Continuing, lost my place in the email. So much malarkey. Yet you claimed I provided no examples, because in the audio that I played at the beginning of this program, she said, I can't think of any concrete examples. She came up with the examples as we were proceeding with the conversation. But continuing, she said, but still, one of your callers inadvertently suggested another area, the area of opportunities in sports. Because society is male dominated and prefers the engagement in sports by men, there is lots of funding for professional male sports in contrast to women's sports. Though black men were prohibited from fully participating in certain sports for years, they now benefit from the expanded opportunities created by this preference and domination. Pause right there. Didn't this past weekend we just give the report about the NFL having to update the Rooney rules because they fired almost all of the Negro male coaches? Don't have any Negro male owners in the NFL. Don't have any of those. We got Michael Jordan in the NBA, but don't have any of those in the NFL. And they fired almost all of the Negro coaches in the NFL and had to update the rules because Negro males are not being given opportunities to get jobs in professional sports. We'll let them get out there and get brain damage. Dr. Curry addressed this directly as well. We'll let a fraction, and that was the other thing that was insulting. It's insulting even to have to respond to some of this. You're citing examples. How many black males on this phone call played in the National Football League? That's what I'm talking about. Pick an example. If we're going to generalize to all the black males are sexist and patriarchal and dominate black females and participate in the domination of women, okay, well, pick an example that relates to all black males. Don't pick an example where you know we're not even talking about 1% of the population. How many black males are going to play professional sports? Get out of here. If you're talking, it's insulting. It's disgraceful. If you just want to talk nonsense and waste time, fine. This isn't even one I would, you can have BGQ, but this is not even worthy of like courteous dialogue. It's absolute nonsense. When she was talking about there are more stars, whatever that means, in the legal field of the academy. Now, again, the overall pattern that is indisputable, which has been for years back to W.E.B. Du Bois' era, was there are more black females in the academy than black males, by far, landslide, hugely outnumbered, gross indictment of white supremacy, and specifically black misandry, keeping black males out. And then this is all you can cite is a small number of black males allegedly were allowed to be stars by whites in a system of white supremacy. And even she conceded, it seems like that might be changing. It's absolute nonsense. You don't even have credible examples. These aren't even examples that, and this is me looking at a legal scholar saying, you don't even have credible examples to back what you're talking about. And that's exactly what Dr. Curry said in the book. You're talking about a concept saying black males have this privilege, and all you can cite is, well, when a Negro male gets shot in the street and they get all this publicity, that's black male privilege. And that's exactly what she said in the audio segment. They get more attention, even though she conceded, yes, Negro males are shot more. It's an embarrassment. It's a disgrace. There's tons of this. And I do wholeheartedly appreciate Dr. Curry pointing this out. Oh, the only thing I can, again, I wish he had quoted from what she said on the cows, because she is not sticking to what she wrote. She is saying the exact same thing. Black male privilege does exist. It's complicated. It's difficult, but you do have black male privilege. Back to the text from this week. Let's see. I thought,
Gus, you've been. I was just going to say that you've been intermittently been breaking up, you know, while you were talking.
I'll double check the audio. Much obliged. I'll double check the audio. The Wi-Fi has been a little suspicious for the past month or so, but I will definitely double check the audio for the recording to make sure that it's okay, acceptable. Let's see. Well, I'll share a point or two and then pause, see if other folks have a thought or questions. I think the line that I tweeted, I'll make sure that I get out. The presumed effects in black males, as a matter of fact, I think that's so important. I just touched on that. It's so easy to just get off on that. There's, and it'll be accepted. Every black males, black females, everybody. I think Dr. Curry pointed that out in the book. I said that repeatedly as we read Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. I think it's also really important because I've had this happen to me and I've seen it happen to others. Where a black male has a disagreement with a black female, and then it immediately becomes that the black male is sexist. It's not that they were even talking about something related to black females. It's not that the black female said something derogatory or anything like that. Not at all. Just they didn't agree. You know, you say tomato, I say tomato. That's all it was. And it becomes, oh, he hates all black females. I've seen that happen before. I've had it happen to me personally. Let's see. The here we go again syndrome. I tweeted it. I thought that was spectacular. And that was a direct quote in refuting his work and said, oh, we don't want to talk about dead niggers again. That's I'm tired of all that. Let's see. Oh, the footnote. I did. I think Thomas in New York had raised the question about the footnote about suicides. And Dr. Curry had a note about suicides in the conclusion. I believe it's footnote. Yep. Got it. It was he says often these deaths are not thought to be of the kinds important enough to learn more about. Black male deaths are normalized. We already know they're constantly in our society. Oh, I missed it. Here we go. It's since 2002, homicide has been the leading cause of death of black males aged 15 to 34. Those black males who seemingly escape the finality of death live to suffer from mass incarceration, poverty, and unemployment, and often seek escape through suicide. That is footnoted, footnote number 4 of the epilogue. It reads, black men and boys are at the bottom of every demographic of study. Put that, hang that on a, that's what I mean about it. And I got to even listen to 2 seconds of anybody talking about black male privilege. Black men and boys are at the bottom of every demographic of study. For the relationship between black male incarceration and societal viability, see James B. Stewart and Joseph W. Scott, The Institutional Decimation of Black American Males, Western Journal of Black Studies 2, number 2, 1978, for a discussion of how stereotypes about black males being criminals and being dishonest affect employment, see Ronald B. Mincy, Black Males Left Behind, published in 2006, for a discussion of how black male incarceration and unemployment show not only that black males have lower incomes than their female and racial counterparts, but also how incarceration creates sample bias across all data sets used to understand black men and boys. See Becky Pettit, Invisible Men, Mass Incarceration, and the Myth of Black Progress, Racist Suspect, She's Been on the Cows. And for black male vulnerabilities to domestic abuse, see Carolyn M. West, also a guest on the Cows, Partner Abuse in Ethnic Minority and Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Populations. Very well footnoted. Did any other folks have questions? Sorry that the line might have been disrupted a little bit. Any other questions, thoughts from listeners?
You heard?
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
I looked it up, Gus. 494 players in total in the NBA, and 1,696 players in total in the NFL. So I don't even think that classifies as 1%. It's supposed to be, what, 40 million blacks? And that's in total. That's not just black players.
Let's say they were all white Negroes. Players. I'm sorry. Exactly. Let's say they were all Negroes. That's we're talking about a thousand. Come on, that's disgraceful.
That wouldn't be a fraction of a fraction of a fraction of what we are. 40 million, and we got together about 2,000. You know, that's nothing. In fact, I'm the second black person ever to work at the firm I work at. I found that out today. They had a black person who worked there 10 years ago. They do have an African guy who's a partner. I'm talking about an American. I'm the second one in 50 years. So they've had plenty of black females over the years, I found out. So I think that it feels safer. You know, it's something about, I think that taken away from, Dr. Wells's definition, the whites are in fear of genetic annihilation. However, it's white supremacy, but genetically we are superior to them. I think that have an imposing person, a black male, you know, that's superiorly imposing to them, you know, that puts them into that, you know, overdrive of, you know, why are all white supremacists? They all have to be white supremacists in order to have, you know, have the way things go the way that they are going. So I think that there's a definite, problem with black males around white males that doesn't really persist. In fact, every job I've had, for the most part, white male patriarchy runs the company, but the people who run the niggas or Negroes are the white women. It's the white women who they put over them. It's like they don't want to be around us. You know, it's really odd. As far as the mental illness, the only point I was trying to make with mental illness was that it was it's a mental disorder. I think that is the leading cause for a lot of the suicides. As far as the suicides go, I mean, that mental illness is the leading cause for a lot of the suicides because I've seen it go untreated. I've seen it go untreated working at the hospital, and people come in and get thrown right in the psych ward, and they're suicidal. And, you know, it's untreated in Black people. It's not, you know, I can't say for sure about white people, but I didn't see any of them. It was all Black people who came in. I didn't see, but maybe three or four in the year I was there going to the psych ward. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. I mean, excuse me, Thomas in New York. Sorry. Sorry, Thomas in New York. Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in, if you had hand up, additional commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, can I be heard?
That is Mr. Demery Four.
Okay. Yes, just one last thought here. On page 232, he said, "This book presents an analysis of racism and patriarchy as it has historically affected Black males. It endeavors to show how Black males, as subordinate racialized males, are victimized by the sexual impositions of this white supremacist society." And up at the top of 233, it says, "No matter the evidence, some will condemn this book because it cares for and centers Black men and boys. Theory insists that they are not the right bodies, not the right story." And I wanted to add that, you know, although the book is brilliantly written and it's meticulously footnoted, and he makes a valid point and backs all of his premises up, he put "because it cares for Black men," and I said, you know, we're in a system of white supremacy when it comes to Black males and Black boys, Black men, Black boys, we get the impression that no one cares about this, all these theories and all the results. We're all, like you say, just niggers. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Any of the other folks that dialed in have a final word they needed to make sure they get in?
Yes, can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Yes, I've spent however long the 1980s up until the present into primarily attempting to witness to Black males, teenagers, the statistics that Mr. Thomas brought out. And this includes males, period. There's over a million males who play, let's say, high school football. That number reduces down to 72, somewhere around 72,000 from my research. And like Thomas said, that it drops down from 72,000 on the NCAA level, NAIA level. We're talking about all the different collegiate bodies as well as the levels. It's 72,000 from a million, some odd people. And it goes to the NFL to a little over 1,000 people. And, you know, you have to communicate that because there's so much hype into deceiving people, as I've heard today, into thinking that that this is something that is almost like a free pass for black males. All you got to do is just show up and you're going to get invited to entertain people. And I would say it's not even essential to white people that we have to be the ones to entertain them. There were times where, of course, we were not involved into professional sports because they didn't want it that way. White people didn't want it that way. So I spend my time doing that, you know, to forming them so to think about alternate ideas and thoughts. You know, if you got athletic ability and someone's giving you a scholarship, then there's some other things that you need to be focusing on, you know, like learning something and having a plan for your future other than the sport itself. And so it's something very vital.
Much obliged, retired firefighter, and just following logic, you are unlikely, any of us, you are very, very unlikely to be playing professionally in any of the ball leagues. Dr. Welsing would say, keep your eyes on the ball, for sure. I will encourage listeners to think. You can email untiljustice@gmail.com. You can post on the Facebook if you have a thought about the next book to read. Hopefully we can get that chosen by Saturday. That way I can let people know on the compensatory call-in the next book so people, you can get it or check it out. Those are four that I'm thinking. Those I think should be pretty accessible. Even Live from Death Row I think is pretty accessible. I see that at like Borders type places. Lots of white people read Mubi Abu Jamal, so, you know. But I think Dr. Curry, phenomenal job. It is difficult to read, but wow, lots of really important information. And again, one of the points that I thought was especially important in this text, him emphasizing that, hey, black males and females have been subjected to the same racist conditioning for centuries. There are not as many differences. I think a lot of times that can be greatly overblown and people thinking that there are huge differences in how black males and females think about racism or how we've been conditioned. And Dr. Curry emphasizing that we have unfortunately been subjected to a lot of the same brain trashing, lots of similarities between black males, black females, victims of racism in the system. All of that said, I can only encourage, if you're listening to the archives or you hung out with us live, take advantage. If you read, listened, something didn't make sense, was not crystal for your understanding, email Dr. Curry. Let him know I didn't understand this on page whatever. I listened and maybe Gus read it wrong. Help me out. And I'm very, very sure that he will respond, get back to you and help you out, answer whatever questions, comments you might have. Take advantage. He's very accessible and very generous. He's been, you know, on the program many, many times. So let him know if you have a thought or question. Take advantage and try to get a full understanding of a book that I think has a lot of constructive info. With that, we'll be here tomorrow for Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Compensatory call-in on Saturday, and we'll have our new book starting next Thursday. Much obliged for folks sharing their time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Whew, man, even behind the wheel, or especially behind the wheel, driver, passenger, you want to be sober and buckled in. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.